What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jeremy Cowan, the founder and CEO of the Schmaltz Brewing Company, creator of Hebrew Beer. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This next to last week of the secular year has been in many ways a very tough time. As you can hear in my voice, I'm recovering from a nasty flu, something that doesn't happen to me very often, and which reminds me that having skipped my flu shot this year probably wasn't a good idea after all. But the temporary benefit of this lingering influenza is that I now sound rather like a Jewish Barry White. Baby, wanna come over tonight and help me kindle my Shabbos candle? Okay, that's probably enough of that. Actually, this morning, what I'm really trying to come to terms with is a much more serious challenge and a genuinely serious subject. A very serious subject indeed, in fact. But before we plunge into that, let's play ourselves in with a non-Hanukkah piece of music for the first time in a long while. This is a beautiful Lechad Odi by the Ben Susan family, a welcome to the Shabbat in the Moroccan style. That was a Lechad Odi from the Ben Susans. My friends, this has been an awful week for America. First, watching the news coverage of police and coroner's reports, and then seeing footage of funerals. The Jewish kid went first, since we bury faster than others, followed by so many more coffins, including very small ones, going into the ground. A very, very tough week. Like everyone in this country and many around the world, I've been trying to find some coherent response to the terrible events in that Newtown, Connecticut elementary school a week ago Friday. And that hasn't just been hard for me. As a rabbi and a father and an American and a radio host, it's been a very difficult thing for everyone. What do you say? How do we make sense of the senseless? When 20 first graders have been shot to death by a 20-year-old guy using a high-powered Bushmaster semi-automatic assault rifle, and each little girl and boy is shot at least 3 times, and some as many as 11 times? When the high-caliber bullets often went right through one child, and then another, and then another? When 12 little girls and 8 little boys, all between 6 and 7 years old, are dead just because they went to Sandy Hook Elementary School that morning? How do you make sense of the fact that 6 adult women, including the principal and the school psychologist, were murdered, some while trying heroically to stop the killer, who had already murdered his own mother that day in her apartment and then moved on to the school? How do you make sense of that? Everyone wants to know why this happened, and some have said that it's simply the natural result of our addiction to firearms, our national obsession with guns and gun-related experiences and games. While they are probably partially correct, Some say it's because we don't have a very good way of dealing with mental health problems. Very little inpatient care, almost nothing available. No way to handle people before they go out of control. They are probably also partially correct. But I think we need to move beyond the why, because there's no explanation that can possibly resolve and make sense of the deaths of 26 completely innocent people. The real question is not why did this happen, it's why could this happen? And that requires shortcutting our troubling national psychological addiction to guns and firearms of any and every description, and simply taking action to make it much, much harder for this, or Aurora, Colorado, or Tucson, Arizona, ever to happen again. America is supposedly a civilized nation. Yet 12,000 people are murdered in the United States with guns every year, compared with just 35 people in Britain, where there are strong gun laws. England is often compared to America for our shared language, our special political relationship, our close alliance, our many similar cultural tendencies. Yet in the area of guns and murder, that's a ratio of 340 to 1 murdered by guns in America, leading, if you will, England. And while it's true that there are 313 million Americans and just 60 million Brits, adjusting for population still makes it patently obvious that we have 70 times as many people murdered by guns per capita as they do. 70 times. You know, I have lots of friends who are gun owners, hunters, even gun collectors, but I am unaware that any of them, at any time, have the need to own or operate a weapon that can fire 42 rounds a minute and be used to shoot through a solid door. I do not know what can possibly explain this horrific tragedy, but I do know one way to start preventing the next Newtown, Connecticut, the next Aurora, Colorado, the next Tucson, Arizona, for that matter. One way to stop that is to ban assault weapons permanently from the general public. No one should have access to these kinds of armaments except the military and some trained and guided law enforcement personnel. Some. No one needs a machine gun to shoot quail, or deer, or even burglars. America may have been built by the gun, but its moral fiber is now being tested and likely destroyed by a strange, disturbed obsession with it, and with the most lethal, least responsible form of firearm. Let's just ban assault weapons now, going forward, and set up a program to buy back all the assault weapons that are out there already prior to a date in the not-too-distant future, after which it will be a federal offense to own an assault weapon. That's what we need to do now, and we must actually do it. The highest Jewish value of all is pikuach nefesh, saving life. The Talmud teaches us that if we save one life, we have saved an entire world. What would we give to save the lives of 20 children and 6 adults? How about 12,000 human beings each and every year? And the comments some people have been making should only deepen our commitment to preventing this insanity. You know, somehow great tragedy brings out all the kooks, anti-Semites, conspiracy nuts, and Israel haters. And sometimes they are all the same person. An Iranian state-run media outlet reported that an Arizona man claims that Israel is behind the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School. You know, there is nothing these creeps won't stoop to saying now, is there? Press TV, Iran's 24-hour English language news network, quoted an interview on a neo-Nazi web-based show, by the way, with Michael Harris, who apparently ran and lost badly in the Arizona Republican gubernatorial primary back in 2006. Wow, we have finally found somebody too incompetent to be governor of our state. But I digress. Anyway, this hack Harris apparently said that the horrible elementary school massacre in Newtown was an Israeli mission to teach President Obama a lesson. Adam Lanza, the man police have identified as the murderer, was the fall guy. Harris publicly associates with neo-Nazis, of course. The Iranian network quotes him saying, "The facts are now becoming obvious. This is another case where Israel has chosen violence and terrorism, where their bullying in Washington has failed." The maniac goes on to say Israel believed the U.S. threw them under the bus after the recent Gaza war, allowing Israel to be humiliated in the United Nations. Israel's response was to stage a terror attack targeting America in the most hideous and brutal way possible. An Israeli signature attack, this jerk says, one that butchers children, reminiscent of the attacks that killed children in Gaza. Yuck. Nothing too low, is there? But wait, there's more. This interview also pinned other massacres that were done by lone nutty gunmen on Israel. This is what Israel did in Norway. The political party that voted sanctions against Israel was retaliated against by a lone gunman who killed 77 children. This is what Israel always does, he says. They go after the children. And so on. Wow. You know, this neo-Nazi nutbag might have also said Israel was behind 9/11 and the assassinations of Presidents John F. Kennedy, William McKinley, and Abraham Lincoln, and the attack on Pearl Harbor, for that matter, and probably shot JR, too. Look, bottom-scraping anti-Semitic scumbags have been around for a long time, and the only thing that really shocks us anymore is seeing how entirely insensitive they are to the enormous pain that real parents, grandparents, family, and friends are experiencing right now. These types are sad and disgusting, but you cannot expect more from such lowlifes. The frightening part about the immediate response to the horrible events in Connecticut is that supposedly intelligent, compassionate, successful people sometimes say things that are nearly as stupid. Mike Huckabee, the TV and radio commentator, former longtime governor of Arkansas, you may remember he ran second in delegates to John McCain in the run for the Republican presidential nomination back in 2008. Anyway, Huckabee, a former president of the National Governors Association and an accomplished Baptist minister, was particularly stupid. Within hours of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, Mike Huckabee made headlines all over the world when he said on Fox News, "We ask why there is violence in our schools, but we have systematically removed God from our schools, and should we be so surprised that schools become a place of carnage?" James Dobson and Joseph Farah, two other prominent radio and website hosts on the religious right, also made statements that essentially blamed this terrible attack on elementary school children, remember, on flaws in American social character. Dobson inanely blamed abortion rights and gay marriage, while Farah stunningly blamed this slaughter of innocents on, get this now, restrictions on guns. Let me get this straight. Grown-up, seemingly intelligent people with actual college and graduate degrees and families are blaming the mass slaughter of children and women in an elementary school wrought by a 20-year-old using an assault rifle carrying automatic pistols because of restrictions on guns? He did this because of secularism or gay marriage or abortion rights? What, sunspots aren't a more credible excuse? Call me naive, but I think the solution to these kinds of horrible events is pretty dang simple. Keep assault weapons out of the hands of maniacs, whether they attack a grade school or a movie theater or a congresswoman at a supermarket. Better yet, keep all guns away from them and give them some mental help. And then it will be a whole lot harder for them to slaughter innocent people who are just going about their daily lives. On a far more cheerful note, when we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Jeremy Cowan, the founder and CEO of Schmaltz Brewing Company and creator of the delicious Hebrew beers, will help celebrate his bar mitzvah year in business with us and tell us what makes a beer kosher, all when we come back on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Jeremy Cowan. He is the extremely creative founder of Hebrew Beer, the most innovative spirit in, I want to say, in all of Judaism, maybe the world. I don't know. Take it any way we place it. Jeremy is from San Francisco, was bar mitzvahed in 1982, by the way. His company has long passed its bar mitzvah. It's probably in its confirmation period now. Went to Stanford, was a brew pub bartender, and then spent 5 months in Israel before starting Schmaltz Brewing Company back in 1996. Good morning. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So, Jeremy, I'm sure you've had this question before, but what's brewing?
Oh, so much is going on with Schmaltz Brewing Company this year. We're in the throes of our most productive, most successful year in the 16 years that we've been in business, which is very exciting. You know, on the business side, craft beer is expanding around the country. More and more people are starting to understand the special qualities of all these incredible small batch beers from small manufacturers around each region and around the country, which is exciting. The awareness and the enthusiasm for craft beer is growing. And along with it, the reputation, the awareness, and the excitement for Hebrew beer just seems to be increasing, which is really fantastic.
You know, when you started, it was, incredibly clever. The beer was good, but it was sort of a novelty approach. You're really kind of past that now, aren't you?
Well, I think that even in the beginning, I definitely was trying to stand out on the shelf, and I wanted to have a lot of fun, and I wanted to tie into Jewish history and tradition and text and the calendar and make it really a part of community celebrations. I used to joke that I started Schmaltz Brewing almost as a Jewish nonprofit. Unfortunately, that was actually the case for many, many years. The last probably 6-7 years, we've expanded into different types of beers, like our Jubilation line, our anniversary beers, Bittersweet Lenny's RIPA. We have a brand new IPA this year called Hop Mana or Hop Mana, depending on where you grew up. And those beers have gotten more and more acceptance in the best beer drinking consumers in the country. And that crossover is a very rare, as we all know, it's very rare for Jewish-themed products to cross over into anything even vaguely mainstream. I wouldn't put us up there in any means with Budweiser or even any of the big craft beers. But we're on the shelf at Whole Foods and Total Wine and Beverages and More and at mainstream stores in the beer section. And the best craft beer drinkers that are drinking Dogfish Head and Stone and Founders are drinking Hebrew, which is pretty shocking and totally exciting and very, very satisfying.
And you really should quell because of that too, no?
I'm excited because I never imagined it going that far. I honestly thought it was going to be at Jewish delis, bar mitzvahs, and weddings. And I'm just couldn't be more thrilled that when I made the change to in my own head, and one of the things that I actually wrote about this in my book that we published last year called Craft Beer Bar Mitzvah, the story of the first 13 years of Schmaltz Brewing Company. The most important transition was in my own head to decide that, yes, I had a Jewish-themed business, and our project and our products had a lot of Jewish content, but I also had a beer company, and that was important, and the quality of the liquid was always important to me, but the level of innovation and the level of specialty and the flavors and the recipes, the intensity of the process that we're doing is, I think, as good as anything on the market. And that part's been really, really exciting, gratifying.
Very exciting and still a lot of fun. And, you know, maybe this is the new Hebrew National. It's got brew in it. So we will come back in a little bit on Too Jewish with Jeremy Cowan.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442. Again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. There's another important holiday coming up this week. My youngest child, my daughter Sipora, was born December 25th, 2000, in St. Joseph's Hospital here in Tucson. She was born at 5 a.m. or so. The doctors didn't make it on time. The delivery nurse did the honors. In any case, a couple of hours after Sipora's birth, there was a knock on the hospital room door. A reporter was there from the local Kagan 9 News, Karen Gavender, Jewish, of course. Who else would be working that day? And the member of my own Temple Emmanuel, and Karen wanted to film the first baby born on Christmas in St. Joseph's Catholic Hospital of Tucson. And the rabbi's daughter, Sipora, was the one. So I went out in the hall, and Karen asked if it'd be okay, and I said, you can film, but you have to say the first baby born on Christmas in St. Joe's Catholic Hospital is the rabbi's daughter of Temple Emmanuel, and she was, at least that year, a Hanukkah baby. By the way, Sipora was sure for all those years that the stores were closed in honor of her birthday. Who am I to argue? This year, on December 25th, Hanukkah will have been over for more than a week, so it can't be that. It must be her birthday. Happy birthday, Yom Huledet Sameach, to the Hanukkah baby of the year 2000, turning 12 today. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And I guess it's still Chag Sameach, at least in Haifa. Tell us about this Chag Shel HaChagim.
It is. You know, Haifa, or Haifa, as I used to call it as a kid, in many ways is a symbol of living together. Jews, Christians, Muslims. Haifa have a big Arab community in it. Every year, at this time of year, when we have on one hand Hanukkah, on the other hand we have Christmas for the Christians, and for the Muslim there is Eid al-Fitr, a very important holiday, Muslim holiday. At downtown Haifa, mainly at the Arab neighborhoods of Wadi Nisnas, there is a very big festival called the Holiday of the Holidays, Hachag Shel Hachagim. It happens every weekend along December, covering all the major three holidays, and allow people from all faith and religions and all walk of life to come and celebrate together. It's an amazing celebration, amazing food. They celebrate Hanukkah with a parade, with a torch parade. People walking down the streets with light torches.
Anunusim lapidim, you know.
Anunusim lapidim, exactly. And they're lighting the menorah. And on another day, they celebrate Eid al-Fitr. And on the third weekend, they have a Christmas celebration with Santa Claus and everything. And that's probably the only opportunity for many Israelis to be exposed, by the way, to Christmas and Santa Claus and all of that, because you don't see that in Israel in any other place. It's an amazing celebration. A lot of music. The Arab scouts are having an amazing parade with drums, and the Israeli scouts are doing a parade with their flags and everything. It's fun. It's really fun. Ethnic music, modern music, Western music, dances, tons of food. You eat way too much. It's a really a celebration.
What a great way to celebrate the multicultural quality. Haifa, as you put it, Haifa, if you are American.
Haifa. Some people say it comes from the word chai po, which is I live here. But, okay, well, we can assume.
A wonderful example of coexistence in a region not really famous for that. This must be a great holiday for kids.
It's a great celebration for kids. Every year I go there with my kids when living in Israel, and on a different story, on a different time, I became a shaliach only thanks to one of those walks through the Chag of the Chagim.
We will hear about that story. And I guess, although Hanukkah is in our rearview mirror now, happy holiday season nonetheless to everybody celebrating holidays here or, of course, in Haifa. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week. Chag Sameach.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
The UN recently accepted the Palestinians as to an observer, no, past an observer status. Well, actually, I'm confused, so some of our listeners must be confused. Not to full status as a member nation of the UN, but what a status is it exactly?
Well, I don't follow the ins and outs of the UN because it's not an institution in which I have a great deal of faith. It is an important institution. It is the successor institution to the League of Nations, which was the most cherished of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points when he instructed our largely inexperienced and largely incompetent negotiators at the Paris Peace Conference, which followed World War I, on their talking points and what their objectives were. They signally failed to accomplish most of their objectives. The Treaty of Paris produced the Treaty of, the Paris Peace Conference produced the Treaty of Versailles, which was such an awful treaty that the U.S. Senate refused to ratify it. And it basically cast the die which made World War II inevitable. But it did create the League of Nations, which succeeded at almost nothing. Except creating a very nice headquarter space for itself in Geneva on a lovely wooded hillside below the international headquarters of the Red Cross and above the lake. And those buildings are now used by UN specialty organizations in Europe, like the UN Economic Commission for Europe and several other things. Before talking about observer status, let me just say that the Arab League, when it was first created, consisted of seven member states, right? Iraq, Syria, what was then called Transjordan, Lebanon, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. And the so-called Arab population of Palestine, in quotation marks, was given observer status. So observer status was something initially granted by Arab states to a group of Arabs who did not constitute a state and for whom statehood was considered an anathema by the Arab League itself. Because to recognize the Palestinian state that was created by the UN General Assembly vote in 1947 would have implicitly recognized also their right to create the State of Israel. So instead, what the Arab countries who formed the Arab League did was, okay, little Palestinians, we'll give you observer status in this organization that's meant to protect you, but meanwhile, please leave your homes and your farms and your villages and flee, because we're going to invade Israel and flatten everything, and we don't want you to be hurt. So go to neighboring countries where you'll get a warm temporary welcome, and 2 weeks later, when we've taken over this new entity, you'll return to your homes. And that has created some of the most intractable problems in the Middle East today. Those problems and what is the future of a Palestinian state or entity or authority or whatever are being wrestled with now by helpful and not so helpful governments around the world and by the UN itself. So we'll return to the most recent developments next week.
Thanks, Tom. Obviously, very complex issue. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie is 65 years old and never married, yet she desperately wants a baby of her own. With the help of the amazing technology of modern science and a famed fertility specialist, she finally has her miracle baby, a 65-year-old first-time mom. When she gets home from the hospital, all her friends and relatives come to see her to meet the newest member of her family. But when they ask to see the baby, Sadie says, "Not yet." A little later, their friends and relatives ask again to see the baby. And again, Sadie says, "Not yet." Finally, a little irked, they ask, "So when can we see the baby?" And Sadie replies, "When the baby cries." "Why do we have to wait until the baby cries?" the relatives say. And Sadie replies, "Because I forgot where I put it." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew. A special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we complete the story of Joseph and of his great father Jacob, also known as Israel, with the final Torah portion of the book of Genesis, Vayechi. It begins with the description of the death of Jacob. Perhaps even more importantly, the final blessings that Jacob gives to his many sons. But one of the most interesting aspects of this section is a brief episode in which Joseph, who knows his father is dying, brings his own two sons, Jacob's grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh, to him for a blessing. In keeping with an ongoing theme in Genesis, Jacob blesses the younger son, Ephraim, before the older son, Manasseh. When Joseph tries to correct his father, Jacob assures him that this blessing order is intentional. Both boys will father great tribes, but the younger will exceed the older in accomplishment. We still use this blessing each and every Friday night when we bless our own sons today, both in temple and at home. In the Bible, we always expect the older child to succeed at a greater level than the younger, to receive a bonus for being firstborn. But repeatedly throughout Genesis, the younger child ends up excelling the older, receiving a greater portion of the inheritance. It's as if there's a clear message here. God has a plan that goes beyond the conventions of human society. As Paul Simon once sang, God only knows, God makes his plan, the information unavailable to the mortal man. For us, this consistent reversal of the traditional roles teaches a different lesson. In the negative formulation, Shakespeare had Caesar say, "The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves." That is, we can't attribute our own failures to our birth order, or our horoscope, or even our parents. What we can do is control our own actions and our own choices. The more powerful meaning is that we each have the ability to shape our destinies. Like Ephraim, or like Joseph himself, or his own father Jacob, we may be born into less favor and fortune than others, but we can make our own way to success and goodness and to God if we work and care and seek holiness. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Jeremy Cowan, founder of the fine small Hebrew brewery and label, and CEO of Schmaltz Brewing Company, will teach us what makes beer the perfect Jewish beverage. Find out on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Four women were detained by Israeli police at the Western Wall last week, one of whom was removed even before entering the Kotel Plaza. According to police, a new decree was issued at 6 a.m. that day, it happened to be Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the new month, forbidding women to enter the Holy Plaza with Jewish religious articles, including Talit and Tefillin. When a group of women arrived to pray at the monthly Women of the Wall group prayer, all of the women were stripped of the articles at the security point. Men, however, entered freely through security with Talis and Tefillin. This new decree is a clear escalation of the restrictions on women's rights at the Western Wall Plaza and has no legal basis, especially in a public place like the Kotel. The Western Wall Heritage Foundation, led by Rabbi Shmuel Rabinowitz and its all-male, all-ultra-Orthodox Haredi Directing Board, has been known to issue similar impulsive decrees in the past and then hold the police responsible to enforce the arbitrary decrees in its attempt to limit women from praying freely at the Kotel. The first woman detained, Woman of the Wall board member Rachel Cohen-Yeshurun, refused to remove her tallit as she entered the Western Wall Plaza. Far from the Kotel itself, she was removed and interrogated under the accusation of disturbing public order and obstructing a police procedure. The other three women, including two young women from the United Kingdom Gap Year Program, Shnat Netzer, and Rabbi Elise Frischman of New Jersey, a prominent American Reform rabbi, editor of our prayer book, and past guest of Too Jewish, were held and interrogated. All four women refused to sign an admission of disturbing the public peace and were released after roughly 3 hours. Elise Frischman is the wife of URJ Senior Vice President Rabbi Dan Freelander, another past guest of Too Jewish. In the interests of full disclosure, Rabbis Elise Frischman and Dan Freelander are personal friends of mine, and we'll have Elise on again when she returns from Israel to talk about the experience of being arrested by the Israeli police for the non-crime of wearing a tallis in the Western Wall, the Kotel Plaza. In a continuing Brit Milah issue involving what most Jews and most rabbis believe to be an unnecessary and potentially dangerous practice, a lawyer for Orthodox Jewish groups asked a federal judge last week to throw out a New York City regulation requiring parents to sign a consent form before their infant sons undergo metzitza bepeh, a form of ritual circumcision in which the circumciser uses his mouth to remove blood from the incision. The lawyer, Shay Dvoretsky, said the practice is prevalent in parts of the ultra-Orthodox community and is a constitutionally protected religious activity. He said that requiring ritual circumcisers, mohalim, to be involved in conveying the city's perspective on the procedure would infringe upon their rights of free speech. That lies at the heart of the First Amendment protection, Dvoretsky said. But a lawyer for the city argued that the regulation was necessary and the practice most likely caused 11 herpes infections in infants between 2004 and 2011, all of them avoidable. Two of the infected babies died. At least two others suffered brain damage. The health department is not looking at the religion in determining what to do about this conduct, said Michelle Goldberg-Kahn, a lawyer for the city. New York City is looking at the conduct itself. The Orthodox groups, including Agudas Yisrael of America and the Central Rabbinical Congress, sued the city in October to block the regulation, which was approved by the New York City Board of Health in September, but is suspended until a ruling is issued in this case. The groups say that the procedure is safe and that the city has not definitively linked infections to the practice. Infectious disease experts, several of whom filed briefs in support of the regulation, widely agree that the oral contact, known in Hebrew as metzitza bepeh, creates a risk of transmission of herpes that can be deadly to infants because of their undeveloped immune systems. And a death last week reminded us of a great story. Carol Walsh, a retired New York State judge whose account of liberating Holocaust victims from a Nazi train led to reunions with the survivors 60 years later, finally died last week at the age of 91. Walsh and other American soldiers liberated 2,500 Jewish concentration camp survivors from a Nazi train at the end of the war. About a decade ago, Walsh's story was posted on a website that his friend Matthew Rosell created for a history class he teaches at Hudson Falls High School, about 45 miles north of Albany in New York. That led to a series of reunions involving veterans and train survivors in New York, South Carolina, and Tennessee. Walsh was the catalyst for everything, Rosell said. He was blessed to have been able to meet with a lot of these people whom he helped. It wasn't until the end of the original two-hour interview with Rosell back in July of 2001 that Walsh, at his daughter Elizabeth's urging, got around to mentioning the train he liberated. He explained how his detachment of the 743rd Tank Battalion of the U.S. 30th Infantry Division came upon hundreds of bedraggled people standing around a long line of boxcars stopped on a rail line near Magdeburg, Germany in April 1945. The soldiers learned the train was packed with Jewish prisoners, mostly Hungarian Jews, who were being transported from Bergen-Belsen concentration camp to another camp. The crew and guards had fled when the American tanks approached. Walsh and his comrades provided protection, alerted U.S. military authorities, sent food and aid to the liberated prisoners, some as young as five. When the story became public, a tremendous outpouring took place. It took a while, but eventually many of the survivors contacted Walsh. 230 survivors so far of that Nazi train came forward, thanks in large part to Walsh's willingness to share his story. He did a great act. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Jeremy Cowan, the founder of Hebrew Beers, Schmaltz Brewing Company, and a wide array of really quite delicious, I don't know if they're technically kosher beers. Can you talk about that a little bit? What makes a beer kosher?
Sure. We get that question a lot, more often than not from the retailers and the wholesalers that are not Jewish that we work with. And kosher and beer is a long been a funny process. For the most part, when I started the company in 1996, I didn't even get the beer kosher certified because in Northern California, the Jewish community is, the percentage of the community that's observant is pretty small. And as most people probably know, most beer would be kosher anyway without being certified. There's right. nothing in, as long as it's all malted barley, brewer's yeast, hops, and water, there's nothing that would be not kosher. However, the debate rages within the kosher community of at least inspection organizations that certain ingredients at these small breweries may not be kosher. So we use Kosher Supervision of America from Los Angeles. Rabbi Lisbon's been with me now for 15 years. And we have them inspect every year all of the ingredients, the brewing process, the conditions at the brewery. We do use a lot of products, more than most, that might raise a couple of eyebrows or at least a question. So we've used figs, dates, pomegranates, grapes. We age beer in whiskey barrels that I found out over 3 years ago has an entire another round of supervision necessary for Passover, which never would have occurred to me. And so they're all certified by KSA now. They have been for years and years, and that's been an important part of our ability to have these beers, you know, as we said, as I said on the labels, participate in the rites and rituals, both sacred and secular, throughout the Jewish community.
And delightfully, so I might add. I should note that, by the way, just because it's kosher does not mean the beer is kosher for Pesach, for anybody who was kind of hoping.
Yeah, you can't make beer kosher for Passover. I mean, we've looked at it lots of different ways, and there was a confusing product out a few years ago that was actually made from honey and molasses. But technically, you know, the whole point of great craft beer is to make it from grain and use a lot of ingredients, a wonderful brewing process, and make very flavorful beers. And so kosher for Passover beer would either be, as they did it, not made from grain, or really not something that would be that exciting. I wish we could, don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah, there'd be a lot of sales that week, I'm sure. I have to share a story. When I was at a rabbinical conference and somebody was getting very emotional, I said, you know, what would you have taken out of Egypt as a slave if you could have taken anything? And one of the women answered, yeast. And I thought, that's pretty true. You get inspired by different kinds of things in creating your beers. Obviously, you've focused a little bit on the Chamesh and Hanminin, the special species from Israel, pomegranate, fig. You also had a great pack for Hanukkah. All right, so how does one build a beer menorah?
So this is our third exploration, the third adventure of the build your own beer menorah. The beauty of this package is it's. Eight different beers from our portfolio, most of which you can't get otherwise. There's can't get in a 12-ounce bottle. So half the pack is all beers that we do in big bottles. And it's eight different beers. You get a pint glass that's logoed each year differently. And you get Hanukkah candles, which I thought was really fun. And then instructions each year on how to build your own beer menorah. And the instructions for me are just as fun writing the instructions each year as drinking the beers. We have some very special products. That Funky Jubilation is in there. The Jubilation Sweet 16 is in there. The Reunion is in there. The Origin, the Hot Mana, the New Genesis, Messiah, or Nut Brown. And so people send in pictures to our Facebook page, and we have a competition of who builds the best beer menorah. And it is just hysterical. I mean, as creative as they want to be, you can put a candle on top of a bottle, or we had a couple of guys sitting in a hot tub last year with holding the beer bottles, and one said Jew and one said Gentile. And we had a guy in a Mexican wrestling mask who was holding it like he wouldn't even let it out of the box. So it's a lot of fun, and people should go to our Facebook page, which is Schmaltz Brewing, and send us their pictures, check out what other people are doing, get inspired, get as wacky and as wild and as meaningful as they would like to, and come share it with us.
And a way to make Hanukkah last the whole year, if you think about it. I assume one of the first instructions is to drink the beer.
Yes, of course. Number one, open the bottle. So the point is to drink it all. It's supposed to be, you know, we're really proud of making these wonderful packages and the packaging and the artwork. My art director, Matt Polachek, here in New York City, one of my closest friends, and we love the artwork and the design process. But we also are equally proud of the recipes, and Paul McRelane is my master brewer that I've been working with since 2003. And we really aim to provide people with special flavors and unique experiences from, you know, drinking a lighter-bodied, lighter-colored beer like Genesis or Dry Hop Session Ale, all the way up to a monster like Jubilation Sweet 16, which is really a beer to share and savor and share with friends.
Jeremy, you had the maybe the world's smallest microbrewery on Coney Island, and it was devastated by the Hurricane Sandy. Talk about that experience a little bit, would you?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the aftermath is really, really a sad story for the neighborhood in Coney Island. The beginning was much more exciting for the world's smallest brewery. We opened a storefront in Coney Island, 175 square feet, but the brew house itself, which was registered with the federal government and the state government, was literally the world's smallest brewery, and it was 1 gallon of beer at a time. We have performers from the Circus Sideshow that we were directly next door to as inspiration for some of the beers. We had parties with them and special releases, and it was a lot of fun. Unfortunately, with Sandy, along with the rest of Coney Island and even Brighton Beach and obviously the Rockaways and a lot of neighborhoods in New York that were just devastated, Coney Island got about 4.5 feet of sludgy water sitting in the entire neighborhood from all the way from the beach back several blocks into the residential neighborhoods. And so all the commercial businesses on the first floor of Coney Island need to be gutted and redone. And it's going to be a long time before everything gets fixed. They've been doing a lot of relief efforts through a website called Coney Recovers, and if you just Google Coney Recovers, you can find out ways to help out the folks that are out there. It's a mixed neighborhood that has a lot of different types of people out there, and they could really use people's help. So we're doing fundraisers for them. We've already done a few, and actually tomorrow night in New York City, we're doing a big fundraiser through the New York City Brewers Guild. This year I'm the president of the New York City Brewers Guild. It's all 12 breweries in New York are donating beer along with some friends from around the country to a fundraiser, and we're donating to a Rockaway Relief group, a group from Red Hook, New York that was also very hard hit, and Coney Island. So if anybody's on the internet, actually by the time we listen to this interview, I'm realizing now that the fundraiser will have happened, but you can still go on to Coney Recovers and donate and get involved.
That would be terrific. And thank you for your efforts. I know that was a sort of a more of a personal than a huge business loss, but still any help that anybody can give. So I want to just direct people to go to their local supermarkets. Well, maybe, I don't know, their fanciest local stores, and tell them to start carrying Schmaltz Brewing Company's beers. And then ask them if they would to please send Rabbi Cohen of the Two Jewish Radio Show some of the Messiah Nut Brown Ale. Just
yes, we've been waiting for the Messiah for too long.
Too long.
Good excuse to pop one open and get a glimpse of what might taste like the future. So it's part of the fun is the shtick and the punchlines and giving me an excuse to learn about passages from the Torah, and also a wonderful opportunity to sit down with friends and coworkers and, of course, rabbis and drink a beer and have a great time and enjoy something delicious.
And if you need any more, you know, reform rabbinical consulting along with Rabbi Lisbon and your smicha, you know, please don't hesitate to call.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to thank Jeremy Cowan for a great visit. What's the website?
Schmaltzbrewing.com. And don't let Google autocorrect you. We're the S-H-M-A-L-T-Z because our version of Schmaltz being a little more contemporary, a little bit trying to figure out how you would write schmooze and shtick and schmuck and schmendrick and schmickle. And Schmaltz seemed, when I first came up with it, to be a little bit more contemporary as S-H-M-A-L-T-Z. And technically, The Yiddish Encyclopedia supported me, so you can go either way. So schmaltzbrewing.com, and come say hello to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well.
And go find a Schmaltz Brew and say L'chaim. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy holidays to everybody. Thanks for a great interview.
Always a pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Ben Sidran, an accomplished jazz and pop musician and academic, and the author of an excellent new book, There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. Our playout this morning comes from a Yiddish classic by the Barry sisters, whose real names were Claire and Myrna Bagelman, by the way. It's called Vias Suskesela. Where is the village? My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Ot is di shtib, ot is duz yingele veimam chobib, ot is duz gesele.